Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I agree with our guest today, Jonathan Rowson, that more and more people are coming out of a cultural closet we made, using the word spirituality with a new seriousness. He is an applied philosopher and a chess grandmaster who explores the influence of our inner worlds on society and politics. The challenge for democracy now is partly, he says, a challenge to change human consciousness. We engage his broad spiritual lens on the great dynamics of our time, from social life to the economy to the climate.
Getting things in their fullest, broadest, and deepest perspective is necessary to actually feel this problem. You know, the crisis of climate change in particular is a crisis of disconnection between the facts and the feelings. We know something is true, we don't feel that it's true. We don't live as if it's true. There is what you might call a kind of stealth denial. We speak as if we believed it, but it's not obvious from our behavior and the way we vote and what we campaign for and how we talk that we accept this as a real problem. And I think that is ultimately spiritual.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Jonathan Rowson has studied the brain, philosophy, economics, and education, and he directed the Social Brain Center at the Royal Society of Arts. And he's co-founder and director of Perspectiva, a research organization in London that examines the relationship, as he says, between systems, souls, and society. One of the threads of your thought and perspective and work is the matter of, well, just using the word spiritual, reasserting it, and then pondering like what it means, what it doesn't mean. And it makes me curious about if you can identify kind of roots of that longing or that perception in your earliest life and perhaps in whatever you would now look back and call the religious or spiritual background of your childhood. How do you think about that?
Well, two things come to mind. I have a particular memory of childhood in mind. But the first thing to say to contextualize that is, I think the sort of spiritual sensibility towards life is entirely natural. There's no need to over-explain it. It's something that's sort of inherent in human nature. But insofar as it's distinctive for each individual, the memory that comes to mind is I'm roughly 10 years old. I'm in a place called Westburn Park in Aberdeen, which is in the northeast of Scotland. And I'm alone, and I'm trying to figure things out. But I've probably got a ball. It's likely to be a white ball. I'm kicking it against a fence that's next to a play park where younger children are playing. And I'm really just biding my time. And I think what was going on in my life at that moment were various things I had to make sense of. My father became mentally ill. My parents separated. And as a young person, I was just sort of thrown into making sense of it. Right. And in that context, I suppose I felt at some level held, that I was at some more fundamental level looked after. And I think it began from there. That gave rise to a kind of a willingness to introspect, to reflect, and those things gave rise to a fuller spiritual life later on.
And when did you start to play chess? Because it also feels like that has shaped you existentially.
No, it has. It has. And, I was 5 years old when I learned the moves. Uh-huh. And I played like any young schoolboy with friends and at school. But then around the period of time between maybe 9 years old and about 13 years old, it really became a kind of passion. And almost every waking hour that I could, I was trying to figure something out on a chessboard. And I think you don't need to be too much of an armchair psychotherapist to see a connection between a young child trying to make sense of the world and seek refuge, and finding some sort of order in chess, and also
making order,
in a place where one can grow somehow.
So one of the ways you've spoken about your kind of driving passion and inquiry now is this. Here's an observation you've made that you are focused on the societal challenge we have become accustomed to ignoring, and that is the inherent nature, meaning, and purpose of it all, that we do problems, we do policies, we do systems, but we don't we don't really even aspire to a grasp of the whole predicament. Mm-hmm. And you make this observation that feels so relevant to me, but I don't think we say this often enough, that one thing that's different about our crisis is that, you know, unlike the Cold War, which I lived through, you know, where it was very clear who the enemy was and what the risks were and what the stakes were, part of our problem is our inability to diagnose and articulate the character of the crisis, which I feel is that grasp of the whole predicament that you're talking
yes.
about.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's an intelligibility conundrum at the heart of our experience. It's we sort of sense something that we can't grasp. On the one hand, the world has achieved a great deal, and we've developed formidably through technology, and you know, there's lots to be celebrated. At the same time, the kind of confluence of existential threats, not least ecologically, but also democracy, you know, fragmenting in a certain sense or weakening, inequality becoming sort of out of control, and then technology maybe overreaching in certain ways. So there's sort of a range of different threats to our bearings of who we are and what life's about. And in that context, we look back to, well, what do we have to hold on to? If everything is a variable, what are the constants? And one way of looking at it, Krista, I don't know if you'd agree, you probably heard from people who've spoken this way before, but one way to see it is that it's kind of like a new axial age. It's a period of time where, yeah. you know, there's such upheaval in the sort of economic and political spheres and technological spheres.
And the axial age was this handful of centuries, like second to sixth or eighth BCE, in which, well, why don't you describe how you,
well,
you know, think about the
you
comparison?
You could describe it as a sort of period of time around the Bronze Age where mm-hmm. technology developed in such a way, places were changing because there were marketplaces emerging, and technologies would make tribal warfare all the more deadly because
right. it was also a very violent time.
Time. Yeah. And in that sort of space of massive upheaval in the sort of external world, people were obliged to sort of almost recalibrate their sense of who they were. There was a sort of shift in consciousness at a global level.
Yeah, well, the Hebrew prophets and Confucius. This was the lifetime of, and also of Socrates and the Buddha.
Yeah, certainly.
But what is so astonishing also about that period of time, because that was also global, is that those were disconnected cultures and countries. And yet it does feel like something happened at a consciousness level because these very kindred and deep things happened around the same time.
And my sense, and I think I'm not alone, is that something similar is going on at the moment. Mm-hmm. People are experiencing a kind of waking up, and it's quite diffuse. It's often quite subtle. You can't be sure if you're kidding yourself, if it's happening. But there's a feeling of a sort of planetary immune response emerging in levels of awareness and attention that may give rise to some new way of seeing the world and seeing each other. Now, we don't quite know what it is yet, but my feeling is that something is emerging of that nature. And yet, to get there, we have to sort of step off the treadmill and the kind of semiosphere around us that's telling us how to live. So we need to develop some kind of immunity to those forces that are constantly telling us who we are and how we should live.
Who we are and how we should live. You said a minute ago, who we are, what life is about. Of course, these are the ancient questions, but they are questions that have to have a place in interior life, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not that that's disconnected from life in the world. And in fact, the point you're making is that it needs to be relevant to politics and society.
It's a challenge, though, right? I'm sure you know yourself that many people who are very interested in spiritual life, broadly conceived, mm-hmm. They're quite happy to stay in that realm and think and speak and be in that place. And then those who are more interested in the political world, likewise, prefer to think in terms of questions of power and influence and so forth. And there are many who recognize that there is a deep connection between these worlds, and broad brushstrokes here, but people sort of in their 20s and 30s, when I speak of the spiritual and the political in the same sentence, they don't flinch and they sort of see exactly what I mean. And those somewhat older want me to sort of clarify very precisely what I mean by my terms.
Yeah, right.
You know, and they want that to pin me down analytically so that I can't breathe.
There's something you say, I think this is a really intriguing idea. You know, you say, so there's this analytical mode with which we do things when we're being serious. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with measurement and precision, and its metrics are numbers. And yet you say, the better part of us is struggling to be heard in public life.
Well, there's a key source for this, which is Ian McGilchrist's work on different forms of attention that we pay to the world. Mm. And as before, I did the Spirituality Project. I did an inquiry into this particular understanding of the world. I think it's a profound viewpoint that needs to be considered, at least. Now, as I understand it, within neuroscience, there was a period of time where people felt that the brain hemispheres were very different. And then there was a period of time where pop psychology got hold of that and sort of ran wild with it and started saying that your left brain was this and your right brain was that. And most of it was bogus. But what Ian did, and he's become quite a good friend over the years, is that he stopped asking the question of what did the different hemispheres do, and instead he asked, what are they like? You know, what are they? What, if you think of a person, you don't ask, you know, what exactly are they? You ask, what are they like? What is that? What is their character? What is their nature? What is their disposition? And what happens really is that the left hemisphere is typically trying to narrow things down to a point, and turn something in, sort of denature something, turn it into an algorithm, turn it into something that is like something else. While the right hemisphere is more sort of broadly vigilant, trying to give context, trying to see something more fully and more precisely in terms of what it actually is. And the reason this is relevant is that these two forms of attention, one that's sort of about focusing in and narrowing down, and one that's kind of backing up and seeing the bigger picture, this is playing out culturally. And the period of time that we're in is one where that sort of narrowing of focus, metrics, everything being overanalyzed, people asking for evidence-based policy, people wanting to turn something into an algorithm so it can be put to scale.
Right, right.
This state of mind is very pervasive, right?
Yeah.
And what we've lost in that is the kind of broader pattern of attention that says, hang on, what are we trying to do here? What is the fuller context in which we're trying to make sense of things? And of course, that's a harder question to ask and answer, because it requires soul searching and working together and lots of things which culturally are somewhat disempowered at the moment. Whereas the mode of operation that's a bit more analytical and precise and zooming in and trying to denature things, that has a certain amount of hegemonic power at the moment, because it's the language of computation, and it's the language of you know, big tech and artificial intelligence, and so there is this, I think,
and it's the language of the stock market, right? It's like the
stock market, yeah, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think when I say the better part of us is struggling to be heard, there is that one reference, but I think it goes deeper than that. It's really about the fact that we are creatures of habit. We're not only creatures of habit in the sense that we have follow familiar patterns, but we're also habit creating creatures. We actually try to make sort of niches for ourselves where we don't have to think too much, and convenience in some ways is how that manifests. Mm. And the reason that matters is that for many things that are habitual and comfortable and convenient may not be that good for us, and they may not be that good for each other and for the planet. And so we need to back out of that to sort of find the part of us that's a bit more free, a bit more considerate, to actually look more deeply at the habits that we're creating and ask if we can do better.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with applied philosopher and chess grandmaster, Jonathan Rowson. this interesting juncture also where, I mean, even the way you just described the way we function is based on a new insight we have into how our brains work, how our bodies work, how we function as creatures, you know, why we became this way. So even at the same time that we can describe things about ourselves that are part of the problem, there's some power in that knowledge, right, of being able to see ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, we are disclosing ourselves to ourselves at some level. And that's a combination of globalization and scientific knowledge, and also maybe material affluence that, you know, having solved many, in many places of the world, having solved the major problems of survival, you move on to questions of, in theory at least, you know, meaning and purpose and self-understanding. So there is this period of time where we are doing this deep soul searching, or at least some are. But I wonder, to be honest, there are times it fills me with hope and there are times when I'm not so sure it's going to work out that well, because I know there's a saying that enlightenment is your ego's biggest disappointment. And I always find that quite a useful expression.
Yeah, why? Why do you find that useful?
Well, the reason I say that is because I think that the desire to know oneself, the desire to sort of, for self-understanding, it's often driven not by a kind of humble sort of service spirit of trying to make sense of one's existence, but also more like a kind of narcissistic identity project. You know, and there's a risk that the motivation for self-knowledge has to be right too.
Yeah, I mean, also this interior life and a true desire for self-knowledge is a necessary complement to spirituality, for spirituality not to, I mean, because, right, we talk so much about meditating, but, you know, meditators can be the greatest of narcissists, right? This is not just, there's more to this, what did you say, the better part of us that is struggling to be heard in public life than, you know, it's not like these spiritual practices actually guarantee enlightenment. And I think
no,
that's
far
what
from
you're
it.
Getting at, right? You're saying,
yeah,
what is this more? And that this more is absolutely relevant to our life together, that it must play a greater role in the public realm.
Yeah, so I mean, the language of spiritual sensibility helps, I think. But to be honest, for those who find even that language problematic, another way to think of it is positive and negative freedom. So we've lived in a kind of liberal hegemony for a long time where the prevailing idea was that the public realm was for questions of sort of resource allocation, and the private realm was where you figured out what was true and what was good and what was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And then kept it to yourself.
Kept it to yourself. Yeah, it was your business. You could, you know, if you want to believe X, Y, and Z, fine, but do it in your own room.
Yeah, and it's interesting also that there has also been in modernity this idea, this kind of assumption, certainly in intellectual circles, that secularization was happening and would continue, and religion would, if not disappear, just become ever more consigned to the private sphere. And in some ways, I mean, religion, I mean, the way I see it is that religious institutions are in a state of great evolution and flux, like every institution. However, as you point out, what is happening instead is not what was predicted, because spiritual inquiry and these questions simply don't go away. It turns out that they are part of us. And you have this great quote. I mean, I've heard this before, but I saw you re-quoted from Julian Barnes. I don't believe in God, but I miss him.
Yes.
And that the sacred and this longing for the sacred, and in fact, this longing for the deep things, the better part of us, that this part of the human endeavor tended, questioned, carried forward in time and community and ritual. This is as vibrant as ever before.
Yeah, it certainly can be, and it's there for people to experience and engage with. The challenge is that it's not perceived that way, at least not in the I know the context in the U.S. is a little different, but
yeah.
And you know, secularization is some way further on here, and but I believe there's some recent survey by Pew Research that says, you know, 90% of the world will identify as being religious by about 2030, give or take. And that's an extraordinary way of looking at it, you know? Like, religion is not going away, far from it. It's actually, it's the sort of secular atheist view that is somewhat irregular. Mm. And it's not necessarily because it's more advanced or more sophisticated. Mm. It could be because it's missing something. What is that God? I don't know if that's maybe going too far, but I think at least we have to be less allergic to the language of mm-hmm. of religion. And not, you know, I have a friend called Elizabeth Oldfield who speaks about the G-bomb with regard to God. But I think a culture that can't use the word God without getting the heebie-jeebies has some serious problems, you know. Like, you should be able to just use the language without feeling that there's a sort of threat in the room.
But I think the important point is what you're driving at. When you say we have to be able to talk about this, mm-hmm. and the words are all inadequate and the words are awkward and they mean different things to different people, but we have to be able to talk about this part of ourselves, about what mm-hmm. this, what it means, what did you say, that to take a look at more deeply at what it means to be human, when we have to have a more fulsome understanding of the human in order to grapple with life and society in the way mm-hmm. that we long to. And that's what that's what this is pointing at.
It is, and I think the sort of preeminent issue of our time is, you know, our only habitat is gradually being destroyed is maybe the right word. It's losing its resilience. Fundamental ecosystems are breaking down, and most of this is happening because of human behavior, more precisely, right. human behavior driven by a certain economic model. Now, in that context, for your average individual trying to make sense of human existence and spiritual life, the connection isn't obviously clear. But I do think many are at home being aware, for instance, of climate change. I believe there's currently a storm on in Florida as we speak. And I know that they'll be wondering, you know, what can I do? This is happening, but it seems so much beyond me. The gap between a single person and this massive global challenge that isn't even simply human, it's sort of suprahuman and it's into the atmosphere and so forth. Then questions of, you know, perspective come into play, like getting things in their fullest, broadest and deepest perspective is necessary to actually feel this problem. You know, the crisis of climate change in particular is a crisis of disconnection between the facts and the feelings. We know something is true. We don't feel that it's true. We don't live as if it's true. There is what you might call a kind of stealth denial. We speak as if we believed it, but it's not obvious from our behavior and the way we vote and what we campaign for and how we talk that we accept this is a real problem. And I think that is ultimately spiritual. And one way of looking at it, to give it a bit of definition, is most religious traditions confront the question of death. They, you know, it's central to the fact that you're a mortal being, that you have to consider how you're going to live with the one precious life that you have. And in the context of climate change, I think there's a very clear parallel between the denial of our deaths, the fact that we can't really confront this fact that we're going to die, and the sort of denial of this planetary emergency. I think the two are extremely closely linked, and yet figuring out in what way they're linked and how facing up to one might help us deal with the other is, I think, a shared endeavor.
This is so interesting, too, because so much of the hand-wringing that happens in the States, at least, is about, you know, the fight, you know, like climate change deniers, which sometimes is a matter of language. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum of that. But you're talking about people who may be using that language and looking at the facts, and yet there's a step we haven't taken that would actually allow us to grapple with this.
I think so. I mean, while I was doing the project, the one of the findings that I find most fascinating, and it's really sort of uncanny, is what we call post-traumatic growth, which is basically when people have some kind of trauma. Maybe they have a cancer diagnosis, or they're in an accident where they just survived, and you know, there's a report of people turning their lives around, living a more intrinsically motivated life with, you know, relationships and experiences at their heart and trying to serve in a certain way. And they're asked, you know, why did you change your life around? And people say, well, I suddenly realized I might have died. And the irony there, of course, is that, you know, they already knew that, you know.
Yeah, they were definitely already going to die.
Yeah, we should, you know, we should already have had that sort of moment of like, hang on, this is part of the curriculum already. Mm. But it's like, we almost have to have that shock. Mm. And I think on many of our major problems, we haven't had that shock, and that's part of the problem.
After a short break, more with Jonathan Rowson. And you can find this show again in three of our libraries at onbeing.org, Cultivating Virtues, Moral Imagination, and Reinventing Common Life. We created libraries from our 15-year archive for browsing or deep diving by topic, for teaching and reflection and conversation. Find this and an abundance of more at onbeing.org.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation, harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. In June, the foundation approved $85 million in new projects to accelerate discovery and inspire curiosity. Requests for funding will be accepted until August 16th. Learn more at templeton.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with the applied philosopher and chess grandmaster, Jonathan Rowson. His work insists on holding a deeper appreciation for the influence of our inner worlds on society and politics. We're exploring how he applies a broad spiritual lens to the great dynamics of our time, from social life to the economy to the climate. So the way you talked about the ecological challenge and the human challenge implicit in that is, you have this book called Spiritualize. And so that's kind of the, I don't know if you would use this language, but it feels like that's like spiritualizing the discussion, our reckoning with the ecology. Mm-hmm. And I want to just ask you about a couple of other areas and how this lens would take them on. So, the economy, economics. Someplace you said, maybe we can't reimagine the world without rethinking the economy, and perhaps it's better not to be an economist to make that case. What is the economy anyway? I frequently sense that there is no such thing. And I think a lot of us feel that way right now.
Right. We should call it out as often as possible. When mm-hmm. someone says the economy, what exactly are they talking about? Well, I think it's true, and I think this is no longer particularly controversial, that economic questions are too important to be left to economists, because they're not at their heart sort of technical questions for a kind of scientific expertise. They deal with questions of how you make value judgments in the world. And moreover, economists haven't done a particularly great job of keeping the world from economic crises or distributing income properly and so forth. Mm. When it comes to the economy, though, more fundamentally, there's a lot of good new economic thinking out there. I'm currently a fellow at a place called the Center for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity at the University of Surrey. Mm. And there, Professor Tim Jackson is the lead, and they're trying to imagine what it would be like to have a viable economic model that didn't assume that economic growth was the be-all and end-all of it. That you had a way of doing the economy that was giving rise to different forms of human flourishing that weren't necessarily about material advancement. And what's great about the way that work's being done is that they're calling upon artists and philosophers and psychologists and people from various walks of life to actually help imagine what an economic system would look like that spoke to human value more broadly conceived. And I think we look at the word itself, I believe, ecology and economy, they have the same root of eco, which I think comes down to home. So there's something I think there's something about the idea of home at the heart of economics.
Yeah.
that we need to reclaim ownership of, because it's our home too. You know, I think there is a place for econometric analysis, but it's not at the forefront of public life. It's once you've made a lot of difficult decisions together, collectively, about who we are and what we're living for, at that point we might want to figure out how we go about making the economic models work. But the economic models themselves are very much a servant. They shouldn't become the master.
Mm. Yeah, it's something that occurred to me as I was reading you and preparing for this, and maybe it's connected to the suggestion you're making, which goes hand in hand with this, that we need to work with realities like death and grief and loss. So is that right now, right at the center, especially of Western democracies, is an incredible amount of trauma that's been kind of hiding in plain sight.
Mm.
Racial, I mean, the history of colonialism, the history of slavery, but beyond that, trauma that has to do with the way we've done gender relationship, the way power has been wielded. And maybe if I think about how you were talking about death a minute ago and how in grieving there's this moment where you feel it. You don't just know it, mm-hmm. you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that certainly this reckoning with trauma, with all of our layers of trauma, is happening at different rates for different people. But to some extent, it's being felt.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying that in a life, that moment can open to transformation.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you get a guarantee that it's transformation. It's a terrible, messy, painful, right? Because there's a moment where you just live with the open wound. And it feels, right? It feels like you will not ever get past this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I hear when you say that is, I think of ritual, actually. Because I think that much of the purpose of ritual was a kind of collective inquiry into some of these deeper and darker aspects of our natures.
Right.
It was a way of sublimating them in certain ways. So when you take communion, for instance, you're remembering a horrific act at some level, but you're not really, viscerally remembering it, but you're sort of acting out something happened, something really important happened, and we're honoring that now. And the reason I think of that is because in some ways, liberal democracy is the sort of thinnest kind of democracy there is, because democracy being of the people, for the people, by the people, a fuller conception of being together, living together, working together, figuring things out together. It's implicitly a sort of communal endeavor, whereas liberal democracy pulls us in the other direction towards the individual. And in theory, those things are very well balanced and they sort of keep each other in check at some level. But I think what's happened is that as our lives have become more and more privatized, these forms of shared ritual, shared experience, shared practice, shared inquiry, disinterested inquiry, not having a partisan interest that you're trying to advance, but a kind of passionate disinterest where you really care about what's going on, but not from any particular vantage point.
Right.
You want to just really understand what's the common good here.
Yeah.
I want to know here, what's the common good here? How do we understand this? How do we get all the voices in the room to help us make sense of this? But those spaces are closing. And what we're having instead is a kind of competitive team sport.
Right.
Playing out as a kind of traumatic experience in public life. So I think it's something to do with the heart of democracy is an underdeveloped theory of human nature that we have to get back in touch with.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with the applied philosopher and chess grandmaster, Jonathan Rowson. You are a father of sons, is that correct?
Mm.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. And they're pretty young.
Yes, one just turned 3, and Vishnu is his name, and Kailash is 9.
You're in that very active child rearing years. all of these ways of thinking and seeing that you live with that are very grand in some ways, practical, but I wonder first of all how, you know, how this changes the way you kind of move through the world, but also how, with living with your children, you know, how it works in both directions, how you take this into how you're raising them, but also how living with them informs, you know, this grappling you're doing, this way you're thinking and evolving your thoughts.
Right. So, I mean, the way you describe that picture, there's someone missing, which is my wife, Shiva, who's okay, the mother of the children. But I mentioned that because someone joked with me when I was becoming a father for the first time. They said, the real challenge for men when they become parents is not becoming a father, it's becoming the husband to a mother.
Mm.
And I think that although it's good. A joke, it's actually a deep joke. It's a very profound joke because your relationship with your partner changes fundamentally.
No, it's right. It's right.
Yeah.
It's another one of these things we don't talk about. We don't talk about how parenting changes the relationship. And
completely.
So
as you paint that picture, I mean, and also Shiva, my wife, is Hindu, so she's brought that sort of richness of the whole Indian tradition into my life as well, and that's also in the children's lives. And I think one way to understand this is that I often look with some envy at friends of mine who are having time to go to public events in London or going on spiritual retreat for 2 weeks, and I'm there doing the dishes or getting the kids to bed or changing a nappy or whatever, or a diaper as you'd call it.
Yeah.
And I'm, on the one hand, occasionally frustrated, and I wouldn't want to pretend that it's all grace and dignity. You know, there's quite a lot of apologizing along the way. But I think what it's done for me is it does get you out of your own head to some extent. You know, there are these other beings. They look at you with their big eyes, and they're, one of the things they're saying to you is, "Daddy, get out of your head. You know, I'm here.
Mm, yeah.
You know, look at me, be with me." So I was joking with a friend, I'm trying to build an organization, but my 3-year-old wants to build a train track. And that's kind of part of my daily experience. So it's grounding, but it can be, you know, I wouldn't want to give it the wrong impression. It can be very exacting, and parenting is often exhausting.
But, yeah, it's physically exhausting.
Physically exhausting. Mm-hmm. And also the joy that comes through, I think there's a famous line in the poetry of Khalil Gibran and the Prophet about the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy it can contain. And I sometimes think about that with children. It's not so much sorrow, but the more stress, the more exhaustion, the more worn down you become through your children, the more the moments of grace and beauty when they do something utterly delightful.
Yeah.
And it leaves you feeling proud and joyful. And you know, you feel it all the more intensely for having gone through the mill a bit to get there.
Mm. Well, I think I want to talk a little bit about hope as we draw to a close. You also gave me this beautiful quotation of Václav Havel, which I know I heard years ago, but it was good to read it again in this moment, which I'm going to read it now. You know, hope is a state of mind, not of the world. It is an orientation of the spirit and orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously heading for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more propitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper the hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. And of course, he had lived through just extraordinary complexity, right? And hardship. Those were hard-won words.
Well, I mean, where do I start? I think with the question of hope, I mean, I think it's incumbent on anyone who would define their work as being in some sense about changing the world, and that it can be quite a hubristic notion, of course, but anyone who is trying to fashion better forms of living, they need some working theory of hope. And I like the definition of Roberto Unger as well, which says that hope is the visionary anticipation of a direction. So it's not just so much about thinking things will be better, but actually sort of seeing a place that's worth going to and orienting your will towards that. So when I quite recently created a new organization called Perspectiva, and the purpose of the organization in some ways is to paint a vision of the future and a pathway of getting there that does instill a certain amount of hope. And I think the only way we're going to do that is if we get better at linking together what we call systems, souls, and society. So complex systems, including the economy and politics and all that, the totality of our inner worlds, and then how we talk to each other and how we live together. And I think if we can get better and more nimble and more generous about how we move between those worlds, then the chance of creating a hope that makes sense for all of us is all the greater.
We haven't spoken about chess this whole time, and you are, of course, a chess grandmaster, and that's such an interesting thing about you that you bring together. And there's one place where I saw you drawing on a chess image. Zugzwang? Is that,
yes.
Is that how you say it? I mean, that's how you say it in German. Is that how chess people say it? Zugzwang,
yeah. I mean, we try to at least. Yeah.
Would you talk about your, you know, not just the word, yeah, but the experience of chess? I mean, I feel like you bring this together in a wonderful way with what political hope is and this experience of chess.
So interestingly, I'm on, in the last few moments of finishing a book called The Moves That Matter, and the subtitle is The Chess Grandmaster on the Game of Life. So I've had some time to think about what this means. And one of the things that I think chess gives you is an appreciation for looking at the whole position, that often in life we end up looking too zoomed in on one particular feature of the position. But chess gives you this disposition to try and see as far as possible what's going on in the state of the world as a whole. And the other thing it gives you is a fairly good sense of the opponent. The fact there's always this alternative narrative, this alternative story coming right back at you, and their reality is no less real than yours. Mm. And what it gives you as well is, rather than thinking of these big grand schemes of you know, how to think 100 moves or 100 years in advance, your main responsibility as a chess player is to play the best move in the position that's immediately in front of you. And obviously that has to be more or less visionary, but still it's good and circumspect just to realize that your primary responsibility is what do you do next and how do you do that well. So as far as possible, I try and keep that in mind as I go through life, not to get too far ahead of the next thing.
And in Zugzwang...
So compulsion,
Yeah, the way I understood that is where everybody feels stuck, right? There's no good move.
So Zugzwang, as I understand it, is it's literally compulsion to move. And the reason it's relevant is that often you don't want to move. So in most occasions in chess, to have the move would be a good thing, and you can make good use of the opportunity. But there are some situations where you can only do harm in your move. And curiously, at the risk of being slightly political, some have described the situation in the UK leaving the European Union as giving rise to a situation of Zugzwang.
Right. So there's no good move.
Yeah, you get to a moment where it feels like you have to make a move, but nothing actually works.
Right.
And then it gets more interesting. You get things like reciprocal Zugzwang, where neither side can move without doing any harm. And then it's all about trying to get it so that your opponent has to move instead of you. And this plays out in all sorts of political ways, too.
Yeah. I think someplace you said political hope depends on humanity not being in Zugzwang. It is a wonderful metaphor for where we are now.
Well, you mentioned Havel saying something makes sense. I think that's the connection I see here. It's that you make a move because it makes sense. You don't necessarily think it will lead to checkmate, but you have a rationale and a feeling that it makes sense and that it matters, and you play it, and then you hope. In the same way with life, you know, you need to do what is in front of you. If that's washing the dishes, wash the dishes, but take the next step. And, you know, you may find that what follows is all the better for that.
Mm-hmm. If I just ask you kind of right now at this moment in your life and the life of the world, I mean, what makes you despair? And where are you finding hope? Where are you looking for hope?
What makes me despair is shrillness. And that comes from all sides of the political spectrum. So those who are so sure of what the problem is, and it's often laced with projection, it's laced with not seeing our own complicity in certain forms of the problem, whether that's attacking the current American administration or lamenting Britain's decision to leave the EU, or whether it's something more proximate, like complaining against all the bankers being terrible or all the, you know, political party that you dislike being terrible. I find that very unhelpful. You know, I think there is a time and a place for winning your battle, but really hope comes from a deep recognition that we're in it together. You don't surrender your disagreements, you don't lose your values, you don't forget who you are, but you assume good faith and you try and build the world together best you can. If you reach a point where it becomes clear that the people you're hoping to cooperate with are not in good faith, then you can vigorously try and, you know, take a different strategy. But I think despair arises when we prematurely help ourselves to an understanding that is inadequate. And so when that combination of partial understanding with sort of moral certitude kicks in, I feel a certain sense of despair. Whereas when I feel hope is where there is a kind of discernment and a conviction about what's going on, but there's also an openness and a kind of generosity of spirit that defines it.
Anything else you'd like to say? Anything you...
The only thing that comes to mind is that I was asked by the Open Society Foundations, which is a sort of massive global organization, to try and help them make sense of the global crisis in human rights as they saw it. And in the process of doing that, I again realized that a lot of it comes down to our working theory of what it is to be human. But I think the real challenge is linking that question as a sort of living, breathing, unresolvable, perennial issue to a particular political predicament. Now, I wrestle with that, whether really this kind of conceptual work that we do can really make a difference to people who are in need. And I've come to the conclusion that it can. You know, I've come to the conclusion that actually finding the right forms of language has real effects in the world. It changes conversations, which changes cultures, which changes practices. And I think those who are charged with making sense of the world and feel called upon to do that should not despair that their work's irrelevant. I think I've come to believe that making the world clearer and looking at our foundations more fully can actually give rise to real results for people who are suffering on a day-by-day basis.
Is there any example that comes to mind in terms of language, a shift of language?
One that comes to mind is climate change itself, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think change is such a neutral term. That I now think in terms of climate collapse. I find it a more useful. Mm. I think climate emergency is too strong. I think climate breakdown makes it sound too mechanical. I think we're looking at a systemic collapse gradually unfolding in front of us. So you need to find a form of language that is heartfelt and true to the nature of the problem, but which isn't shrill and doesn't provoke a needless defensive reaction. Given that that language is perpetuated and multiplied by a million and million plus times around the globe, finding the right form and the right reverberation of language really makes a difference in terms of how people feel it. Because as I said earlier, the main challenge on that particular issue is learning to feel it. So collapse, not change, because our lungs collapse, financial systems collapse, and we collapse in exhaustion at the end of a difficult day. I think people can relate to that. So if we say the climate is collapsing, it's so much more evocative than to say it's merely changing.
Jonathan Rowson is a co-founder and director of the research institute Perspectiva, based in London. He's also the former director of the Social Brain Center at the Royal Society of Arts, and he is a chess grandmaster and British chess champion. His books include The Seven Deadly Chess Sins and, more recently, Spiritualize: Cultivating Spiritual Sensibility to Address 21st Century Challenges. On Being Project is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
Zach Rose,
Siri Grassley,
and Nicole Finn.
The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice that you hear singing at the end of our show is Cameron Kinghorn. On Being is an independent production of the On Being Project. It's distributed to public radio stations by PRX. I created this show at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the John Templeton Foundation, harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. Learn about cutting-edge research on the science of generosity, gratitude, and purpose at templeton.org/discoveries. The Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Kalliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is produced by On Being Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota.